Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Unfathomable, a podcast about UFOs and human evidence, tells the stories of close encounter witnesses in their own words. No interpretation, no debunking, no middleman. To listen, subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. And for information on how to share your story, find us on the web at unfathomablecast.com.
Hey guys, Ryan Sprague here. As you all know, the Somewhere in the Skies podcast is always free to consume, but it isn't free to create. That's why I've started this Somewhere in the Skies Patreon campaign. On a monthly basis, you give what you think the show is worth. You'll be helping the show continue, grow, and to be something truly communal. And remember, there are rewards for each level of contribution, and the list is only growing. So please, help Somewhere in the Skies now by becoming a patron. To contribute and to learn more, visit www.patreon.com/somewhereskies. Thank you for your support. And now, on with the show.
This is Somewhere in the Skies with Ryan Sprague.
Welcome to Somewhere in the Skies. I'm your host, Ryan Sprague. I saw what I believe to have been a UFO when I was 12 years old. That event clearly had a huge impact on me and how my life played out ever since. And this got me thinking about a topic that I haven't covered yet on the show, and that's childhood UFO encounters. We often ignore the small voices of children, brushing their words off as pure imagination. But when the eyes of hundreds of children witness a UFO at the same time, it's hard to ignore that something is going on. Is it merely children making up stories? A mass hysteria running through their impressionable minds? Or are there actually intelligences from other planets visiting these children to attempt communication when adults simply can't or won't listen? Today, I speak with Michael Huntington about some of the most interesting and bizarre cases of children and UFOs, stretching back almost a century and all across the world. Michael is a paranormal travel writer and UFO researcher living in Cape Girardeau, Missouri. Each year, he travels with his wife and two young boys to dozens of strange and interesting locations throughout America, chronicling their adventures in blog form known as Strange Travels. Michael has researched the UFO mystery for over 40 years and frequently writes on issues related to the reform of ufology and improving rational methodology. He has been interviewed on television and numerous radio programs discussing a variety of paranormal topics, his family's unusual travels, and the enigmatic UFO subject. So, without further ado, here's my conversation with Michael Huntington. There is a topic within the UFO subset that I've wanted to cover for a while now, and I couldn't think of a better person to bring on to sort of hash this out with me. We're going to overview some of the most famous child UFO cases in UFO history. Like I said, this is a subset of sightings that often gets overlooked, and now what I find, as I'm sure you do, Michael, is that children usually are honest. You know, they're innocent bystanders when it comes to this topic. So, again, usually you're getting this unfettered, sort of uncensored account when children have a UFO sighting or encounter. And those encounters are often very dramatic. And what I didn't know personally is that there are many more cases that I first thought could be lumped into this category. There's so many of them out there. So I'd love to go through a bunch of those today. My guest is Michael Huntington. Michael, thank you so much for joining me today, man.
Oh, it's always great to talk to you. And I'm looking forward to discussing these cases. They're definitely interesting. And I think it might surprise people with what we came up with here.
I think so. Like we'd been talking about earlier, there's a lot of literature and documentaries that are going to be coming out soon about this very topic of children and UFOs and why so many kids have seen UFOs throughout the years. So I think it's very appropriate that we kind of run through this and, you know, get that out there so people can look into it before all of this really stunning revelations and documentation of these come out. So again, thank you. I guess we sort of have to start really early on. And one of the first cases that you and I came across was the 1917 Fatima sighting in Portugal. You know, while many believe this to be a religious experience, the actual accounts were very similar to a UFO sighting, if I'm not mistaken. So maybe you could sort of run us through this and get us started on encounters with UFOs.
Yeah, definitely. And before we jump into this, I would want to say that you're absolutely right. This is just skimming the surface of these type of encounters. And we're going to try to focus on, some of the better documented ones, the ones with a lot of witnesses. But there are certainly hundreds, if not thousands, of other cases out there just involving children. And really, a good place to start would be 100 years ago in Fatima. And you're right. When people look at this story, this account, it's definitely viewed as a religious miracle. And it can certainly be viewed through that angle. In fact, all the participants viewed it through, a rural peasant Catholic viewpoint when they tried to interpret what was an unusual series of events involving lights in the sky and people coming down from the lights and giving messages, which, even if you separate the religious aspect, you at least have on some level, if there was indeed an incident, pretty much a classic encounter. In 1917, what this began around was three children, and they were peasant sheep herders. They were around like 7 or 8 years of age, and, they were looking after their flock, and they had a series of lights come down from the sky, and glowing beings, which they viewed as angels and the Virgin Mary, came out and gave messages. And there was, five events that took place over the course of that year, and it became engulfed, by the local Catholics in the area as a miracle. And towards the latter parts of these encounters, there were possibly tens of thousands of witnesses to strange happenings in the sky.
Whew. Now, talk about a mass sighting.
Yes, I think some numbers for the October 13th encounter, which was called the Miracle of the Sun, had somewhere 70,000 witnesses.
Wow.
Whether or not we could attribute this to some sort of religious mass hysteria coupled with, some sort of atmospheric phenomenon, that's sort of separate from, the issue as to whether or not something happened. And there's a lot to suggest that there was at least at the outset with these children some sort of physical event, some sort of actual, glowing craft, with lightning shooting out of it. We got a lot of the elements here that went on into some of the contactee stories. These children ended up becoming saints. They're on their way to becoming saints. They ended up going into the clergy because of this miracle, and they had revelations that they got from these angels relative to, a lot of the contactee messages of, let's end war, let's, work together, sort of the utopian vision of what Earth should be. Mm-hmm. So it's really an intriguing case, and it's a good kickoff to looking at cases that involve kids, because they definitely have had their impact, and this is a good one to start with.
I think so, you know, and children are so susceptible at first, you know, when these kids clearly were raised pretty religious, I would assume, at this time, that they would perceive this as a miracle, that this was the Fatima. And I think that's pretty interesting. We do hear this a lot, that people who have UFO sightings, a lot of them consider it a religious experience. And I'm sure some of the other cases involve that as well that we'll go through. But yeah, let's fast forward, Michael, to what do we got next? We've got 1952. Now, this is a case that I covered on a Patreon bonus episode of Somewhere in the Skies, and that's the Flatwoods Monster. By far, one of the most incredible cases out there, one of my favorites. And it's pretty well known in West Virginia, you know, where this happened, but to many monster and UFO hunters, it's basically, it involved both of these things. So you got to tell us a little bit more about what you know about the Flatwoods Monster, Michael.
Yeah, the Flatwoods Monster is one of my favorite cases because it's just so weird, you know. It's yeah. it's got 10-foot tall creatures and weird saucers and, you know, government men coming in to, you know, hush everybody up. So it's got all those sort of, you know, classic elements that you would find in any sort of science fiction film. But Flatwoods, when it happened, you know, in September 12, 1952, that the time period of the 50s was starting to, you know, get that science fiction element, you know, influenced within the culture, you know. You were starting to get a lot of sort of science fiction ideas there in the culture. And so when this story came out, it was definitely picked up by the media. And, you know, 52, you know, that period, everybody was saucer crazy. And this story became one of the most famous ones of its time because it was all over the media. And, you know, even Blue Book looked into it, and pretty much all the researchers of the time period had opinions on this case. And what it was is on the evening of September 12th at around 7, there were some kids playing football, late night football, you know, right around sunset. Kids will do that until, you know, their parents yell at them to come home. And there were some kids playing in the school's football field, and they witnessed an object like some sort of fireball or reddish ball fly overhead and go into some of the nearby fields, you know. So as any group of kids that would witness something like that, you know, you're going to start running, going towards it, you know, at least the braver kids.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm sure there's some kids that said, oh, nope, time to go home.
Yeah, that would be me, not going to lie.
Right. But some of them did venture up towards where this object presumably came down and collected a couple other kids along the way, maybe, and got an adult with them. But yeah, I think it was Edward and Freddie May, and then Tommy Heyer and Neil Nunley and Ronnie Shaver and Eugene Lemon, along with Kathleen May, who was the one adult. They all ventured, climbed over a fence and went into the Bailey Fisher farm where this object, where they thought it went down. So, you know, it started to get dark. They're going up here in the dark. There's a group of them. They're all kind of excited and they're moving up towards what they perceive to be an object, you know, some sort of maybe car or truck sized object, kind of a orange reddish pear, you know, smoke coming off of it, sort of hissing, you know, flying saucer, meteor, who knows. You know, they were all kind of frightened. They noticed it kind of smelled weird, like, you know, some sort of diesel fuel or some sort of chemical smell. There was sort of a weird mist all around. You know, yet they ventured closer to try to get a better view, and as they approached, they saw a creature about 10 feet tall with big yellowish eyes and a big red circular head and some sort of big, you know, apparatus around its head, you know, possibly some sort of helmet or whatever, and, you know, a long metallic skirt and little, you know, spindly hands. And they were stopped dead in their tracks and ran away, flew back home, and, you know, did what normal people would do. They would, you know, call the police you know, from there, you get your, you know, typical response. Of course, nothing's going to be there when you get there.
Yeah,
you know, maybe a little bit of weird, you know, slime on the ground, maybe a little bit of mist left over, sort of a weird smell. But, you know, nothing was there when the police investigated. And as with these cases of the time, you know, the local military did take interest. You know, you had National Guardsmen out there looking to see if, you know, if there's anything out there that they need to be concerned with. And you know, there was nothing. So ultimately, you know, due to the lack of evidence, you know, the government, or I don't know, maybe there was evidence, maybe it was covered up, who knows, but you know, it sort of has been labeled as, you know, a meteor event, you know, that a meteor came down, although I would think that there would still be a meteor there, you know, so that doesn't kind of, you know, really wash. What happened there? Who knows? Maybe some sort of, you know, actual, you know, geological event, maybe some sort of craft, maybe some sort of hallucination connected with, you know, that gas. Who knows? But it's definitely an interesting case. Maybe kids are more open to see this sort of thing. Maybe, although the one adult that was with them was certain that she saw the same thing. So it's one of the best mysteries, to offer.
Yeah, and I mean, even up until today, people still celebrate this encounter there. I mean, you've got like a Flatwoods Festival every year, and that's another interesting thing is how towns embrace these things. I know you and I have talked about this in the past, is when these things happen, they ultimately become the history of these towns, and sometimes the only history of these towns that ever make it out to the mainstream.
Yeah. And Flatwoods is one of those stories that sort of ebbs and flows with, you know, the culture and, you know, how it's perceived. Definitely, I think people will find even more interest here. Our friend Seth Breedlove's doing a Flatwoods movie. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when his documentary hits, I think that'll add a lot of more interest into this intriguing case, which still remains a mystery.
Up until this day. Well, I mean, the next one we're going to cover, man, this is going to bring us way across the ocean. And it's perhaps one of the first school sightings that involved a mass sighting. And this happened in Melbourne, Australia, in 1966. So can you tell us a little bit about the Westall encounter?
Yeah, the Westall encounter is probably one of the more, if not the most famous mass school encounter sightings. And it is pretty much the template for, you know, for a lot of these type of encounters. Yeah, there's so much that's been done on this on this subject. And it stands as the best because there's so many witnesses that have come forward. There's been a lot of great solid research. You know, Shane Ryan down there is pretty much you know, continued to work this story, and you know, he's probably the best guy to talk to on this subject, because you know, there was definitely something there on that day.
I stood there absolutely transfixed and saw the most amazing thing I've ever seen in my life, and it took a while for me to sort of comprehend what I was actually looking at, because I'd never seen anything like that before.
There was three. The one that was closer was just in the sky, just sitting there. And then it went down, came up, and then banked on its side and took off. Really, really fast.
It was moving away. So it had lifted off with the oval, okay, and it was moving away. From us, and we just were gobsmacked, started chasing it, and my girlfriend and I sat on the fence, climbed up the fence and just sat there and cried. We thought it was the end of the world.
Before I came down into the paddock where the kids had seen this thing land, the paddock grass was about knee high, and as I walked through with pushing my bike with my uncle, I saw a group of about 20 people all huddled around looking at the ground, all looking at a circle. Perfect circle. It was probably about 4 or 5 metres in diameter. The edge of the circle was perfectly formed. It wasn't as if you could, you know, cows or any other animals or even the kids had come in and just rolled around. It was too perfect.
I mean, I know what I saw, and in fact, I don't expect them to believe me, because when it happened, I didn't believe what I was seeing, because it wasn't possible. What I was seeing wasn't possible.
And it was an April 6th in 1966, and there were some kids that were outside, presumably for, I guess, for recess or maybe a field day, and they witnessed a couple of flying saucers, you know, your classic silvery two-disc objects, you know, flying over their school. Mm-hmm. And as any large group of children would do, they became excited and, you know, screamed and yelled. And there were hundreds of witnesses to this. Pretty much, I guess the whole school soon learned of the objects outside, and everybody pretty much left their classrooms to run outside and run towards the objects, which you know, had flown overhead. There were, I guess, the airplanes surrounding a couple of these objects at some point. Some sort of a single engine prop plane, maybe like a Cessna or a Piper or something. More than likely, a civilian type craft. And some of the kids noticed, I guess, that at least one of the objects or some of the objects went behind towards a wooded area called the Grange, adjacent to the school property. You know, there was a kind of an unused field area where a lot of the kids had hung out. Some of the children had reported that something had landed out there. There were so many different reports like that that it sort of makes this event, you know, uncontrovertible as to whether or not something happened. Something certainly happened, you know, to have so many witnesses, whether it was, you know, a military sort of thing. You know, it's interesting that so much has been covered up. I mean, you know, a lot of the, you know, the news stories and reports just sort of disappeared, and a lot of the paperwork, even though they were definitely on location for that event within the following days, you know, it's definitely intriguing. It's more so than any of the other experience or encounters. It has, you know, sort of the conspiracy aspect to it, the cover-up element, more so than any other.
Yeah, I would have to agree. I mean, well, in terms of the actual encounter, Michael, we had another one that happened that same year. This is back in the United States in Miami, Florida. This is an Opa-locka sighting. Could you tell us a little bit about this one?
I could tell you in short that at the Crestview School in Opa-locka, Florida, April 7th, 1967, just, you know, the following year after Westall, pretty much almost the exact same thing that happened in Westall happened there at Opa-locka.
Right. Yeah,
to some degree, you know, if it may have lasted actually a series of days, but same sort of instance as with Westall. You know, a group of kids spot an object. You know, they rush towards the object, and teachers and large groups of kids, again, in the hundreds here, just as there was in Westall, along with teachers, you know, witness an object just beyond the perimeter of the school in sort of a wood swampy field area. They witness an object, or maybe even multiple objects, sort of flying around in the distance, through the air, you know, throughout the trees. And who knows? It's very similar to Westall, which is, it really makes it intriguing. And it became a big story for its time period, probably because of the National Enquirer, which was literally based down the street from, you know, where the school was in Lantana, Florida. So, you know, they definitely pushed the media on this. And it was pushed at that time period. It became a national story. But it sort of died down when the Navy, the Coast Guard, actually, as well as the Navy and NASA and some of the other nearby facilities, initially pushed it off as helicopters doing maneuvers, and then followed by flares. And, you know, that sort of outraged a lot of the witnesses in the community, because by that time, you know, within a few days of the school event, other people had seen other objects throughout that area. So that sort of, you know, infuriated the townspeople, you know, when those explanations came forth. And the Navy even did a demonstrative flare drop to try to show that what the people had seen was flares, very similar to, you know, what would be tried later in Phoenix.
Yeah,
you know?
Phoenix lights. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, is this maybe one of the first instances where, you know, flares were dropped to dissuade, you know, UFO sightings? It's quite possible. But
you have to wonder, you know, with all of these mass sightings happening, how many weather balloons and flares do the military have in stock ready to go when these things happen? You just have to wonder.
Yeah, and these people, you know, in these communities, it's not so much that they were minding, you know, being called liars, which I'm sure they didn't appreciate, but they live next to military installations. They're not stupid.
Yeah.
You know, I think they were more offended by that, you know, we know what a Coast Guard helicopter looks like, you know.
Right.
So similar sort of thing in Gulf Breeze and some of these other, you know, military aviation communities, you know, mundane explanations for what these witnesses are seeing, it just, you know, really doesn't hold water.
Yeah, it's pretty offensive, if you ask me. Well, the next one that we decided to cover, Michael, was the one in Connecticut. Now, this was at Camp Delaware, and this brings us up a mountain with some young hikers. So we're moving away from schools. We're moving into the woods. So could you tell us a little bit about this 1976 sighting? I really found this one interesting.
Yeah. Even within, you know, child encounter cases, there's sort of this, you know, Boy Scout in the woods sort of encounter idea that has been demonstrated throughout, you know, the history of the subject. You know, even back in 52 with the famous Florida Scoutmaster, you know, where, you know, a Scoutmaster and his little group, you know, see something in the, you know, in the forest and, you know, the Scoutmaster gets burnt or whatever, you know, so that sort of story was around even in the early 50s. And Camp Delaware is a very similar sort of account along this line. It was a group of hikers. They were about, I guess, probably 14 or 15 of them, 14, and then their hike master. They were teenagers, 14, 15 years of age, and they were hiking near Camp Delaware in Winston, Connecticut in 1976. This was July 28th. They were part of a camp program, and they were hiking towards Blueberry Hill, which was a nearby feature, a pretty decent hike. And as they neared an area with a bit of a clearing, they could see an object come down that was a saucer with a red dome, as it was described. Mm. And, of course, they all stopped in their tracks and, you know, they pointed and I don't know if anybody took any pictures. I haven't heard of any pictures being taken, but supposedly the object had, you know, dipped down and it landed possibly behind some trees. And the kids, you know, they ran back. They went to the police and it was investigated. And it was investigated as credible, not just because the counselors saw it, just maybe from the fact that they were, you know, they were scouts, and these kids were, you know, not the sort that are going to lie together, you know, to the police. So, you know, they got a lot of credibility just from the fact that, you know, they were, I guess, sort of model citizens for that time period. But it became a case that was investigated by APRO, the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, which was one of the leading groups in the 60s and in the 70s. And they did a thorough investigation. They investigated the area. There were no trace evidence found, but from the veracity of the witnesses, and these are teenagers. These are, you know, older than you know, some of these other accounts where you know, the kids have been around, you know, 10 or even younger. When you get to teenagers, the credibility, you know, goes up a little bit, especially if there's an adult involved, because. Yeah. Yeah, less likelihood of some sort of, you know, practical joke. Not that those don't occur, but this case, the Camp Delaware case, was considered one of the better cases of the year.
And I mean, you have to wonder what kind of badge they have for UFO hunting for these Boy Scouts. I think they definitely would have gotten that one. Wow. That's really interesting. And you bring up some good points. Like, these kids wouldn't, why would they make this up? You know, you learn so many good things when you're going through the Boy Scout, you know, thing. I did that growing up as well. And they teach you to be honest. So to have made this up, I don't see it happening. And to have an adult witness this as well, they definitely saw something. So that's interesting. Well, and let's move across the pond this time, Michael, and we're going to Broadhaven. This is in Wales. Same year, a year later, 1977. And this is one of the more dramatic encounters that bore a striking resemblance to another case that we're going to talk about shortly, one of the most famous. So could you tell us a little about this case out of Wales?
Yeah, Broadhaven, February 4th, 1977. It was the Broadhaven School. I guess it was in the morning, or I'm trying to think of what time of the day it was, but same sort of deal with a lot of these other cases. The kids notice out through the window something, or they're on the playground and they notice something, and they all sort of, as a group, you know, sort of vacate what they're there to do, you know, that day, to run outside and witness, you know, what they think is a flying saucer landing in a field nearby the school. And the same thing happened here to a class full of kids in this small Welsh town. Kids were around age of 10, and they witnessed some sort of like silvery object with like a red light. I don't know if it was intermittent or if it was solid, but they definitely perceived, you know, saw the red light. That's what got their attention. And they witnessed this object go down, you know, nearby where the school is. So, you know, wanting to get a closer look, they do. And they see an object, and they see nearby, I guess, what is some sort of silvery being of some kind, some sort of a robot or a creature or whatever. Yeah, definitely weird. When kids start seeing robots, that's really when it starts to get interesting. Yeah. You know, because it always seems to be the children. Well, not always. The kids definitely, I think, are more prone to see robotic type beings. Mm-hmm. Which I don't know what that means. You know, maybe there's some sort of psychological component, you know, related to the children, how they're perceiving and the phenomena, or maybe, you know, there was just coincidentally some sort of robotic creature out there. But this area in Wales, this account has sort of become a big deal. There's a whole area near Broadhaven that has been called the Broadhaven Triangle now, because so much happens within that area related to, you know, strange phenomena, mm-hmm. Especially aerial phenomena. So, you know, 40 years on, this case is still looked at as an important case within British ufology, and it's still celebrated, and there's still strange things going on where the event near the school happened. Now, some people have come forward saying that it might have been a hoax, not on behalf of the kids, but, you know, maybe a practical joke or a prank being conducted upon the kids by somebody else, you know. But I don't know. That's a lot of work, yeah. You know, to build a flying saucer. And you know, not that it can't be done, but I'd imagine that people have better things to do with their time, you know. And we would have heard a little bit more about such a hoax after 40 years, you know, so right. Still an interesting case.
Yes, we do know that when the British hoax something, they definitely want it to be known, hence crop circles. I won't go any further.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, here's another one, Michael. Now, this happened in 1977, this time in West Pittsburgh, California. This is one of the most interesting because J. Allen Hynek, the man, the myth, the legend, he actually considered this one of only three credible humanoid encounter cases in that year. So could you tell us a little bit about this case out of my new neck of the woods, California?
Yeah, this is definitely a case that I think people should go back and take a look at. It is a Center for UFO Studies case primarily. So, you know, you start off with a lot of good credible people involved in this case. Richard Haynes, Harder, Hynek, you know, all these guys were involved in some sort of investigatory aspect with this case. So what happened? May 20th, 1977, West Pittsburgh, California. This is a case of three boys wanting to, you know, enjoy some of the rural area, I guess, nearby them. I think they're actually looking to maybe, you know, just spend a day exploring, hanging out, maybe going to the beach. They weren't really, you know, sure what they wanted to do, but they were enjoying the outdoors. And it was Lenny Young, George Ferreira and Patrick Morrison. And as they were hiking through the woods, getting ready to hitchhike, I think they were at one point, they...
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
They encountered an object in the road, sort of a flattish saucer, maybe kind of a bluish tint to it. It looked like your classic sort of flying saucer, but it was, you know, maybe a little squatter. It really gets strange. Soon after, they noticed that there's, some sort of beings coming out of this craft. They were sort of shadowy. They were, sort of robotic. They were kind of nondescript. They were kind of difficult to describe, but the boys all definitely claimed to have seen these beings and that they were, sort of smoky and ethereal, yet robotic. There was a lot of mist. There was a lot of smoke that was put around the saucer as well. So definitely interesting, definitely weird. I don't think there was too much physical evidence gathered. Again, this is one of those cases where through interviewing the witnesses, looking at motivations, looking at locations, looking at consistencies within accounts, all the motivating factors that you have from interviewing witnesses, I think this became a solid case just based upon the testimony. Now, either these kids got their story, just worked out really well, or, they had a shared event. And a lot of noted researchers at the time were convinced that they had a shared event. What I think is interesting is the description of, the beings, which mm-hmm. It is really not found anywhere else. And it's, the fact that they were kind of, nondescript and really couldn't see features, that they were shadowy, that sort of makes for interesting possibilities to consider, relative to, how these creatures are perceived. Again, whether or not they can change perception wise through, the boys themselves, who knows? It's definitely interesting.
Yeah. Very unique and bizarre. And I think that's when, things start to really get interesting and when that credibility factor kind of gets bumped up a notch, when something is so utterly different from these prototypical things we hear. A lot of these cases involve very similar things, robotic-like things, landing in the schoolyard, this, that. This is one of those cases, like, Hynek said, where it was so different. And like you said, it was so, concrete between these three witnesses that, definitely something strange happened in what these creatures were. Unfortunately, we'll probably never know, but interesting nonetheless. But all right, my man, here's one that when I read this description, we got to prepare the listeners for this one. We've got a three-eyed alien, and a robot. So we're back to robots again. This is in our friends, the USSR. This was in 1989. So please, you gotta tell us. Everyone get your whiskey. You gotta tell us about this one.
Well, my friend, let me tell you an old Russian story. No, I can't do the whole thing with that accent. No, this is probably, when it happened, it was probably, and I remember this very distinctly, probably the top news story of the day. It was on all the newspapers, and it was a Russian TASS story. And, you know, we're talking about the old Soviet Union here, even back then, you know, government controlled. So whatever was released by the Russian government. And this story was released to the American press as a big story, you know, throughout the world. So, you know, the story from the motherland took place September 27th, 1989 in Voronezh, USSR. Small urban, you know, industrial city in eastern. I guess it's in Russia. You know, there's a lot of Russian states over there, and who knows where they're at now. No, but it was, you know, industrial Russian city park. You know, end of the Cold War era. You know, so everything's the way I pictured everything is kind of drab and dreary. You know, mm-hmm. like you see, you know. Russia in the 80s, you know, but they love their kids just like everybody else. And, you know, they had parks and they enjoyed spending time outdoors. And the South Park, Voronezh South Park on this day, there was a number of kids playing and, you know, some adults and people walking by in the streets. It's a public city park. And the kids began to notice a red, maybe a pinkish red sort of object, like a circular, you know, like a cherry in the sky, just sort of coming down towards the park. And, you know, of course, everybody's pointing and looking and their mouths are open and they're saying stuff in Russian and screaming in Russian, I'm sure. And the object comes down and lands in the park, you know, near the playground equipment where the kids are. So I guess the kids are the closest, you know, to this object. Good size object, I guess, maybe the size of, you know, a semi truck or, you know, somewhere halfway big enough for, you know, an 8 foot tall or a 10 foot tall robotic creature to get out of, you know, or,
yeah.
Or, you know, some sort of three eyed alien, because that's pretty much what happened.
I was standing not far from the main road of the South Park, and I saw this flying object at an approximate height of 200 or 250 meters. It stayed at the same height and did not move horizontally. I was very interested by all that, because it could not be any kind of meteorological balloon.
There was a squeaking sound. Perhaps some drilling tool was operating, like it was boring a hole in the ground.
The creatures started coming out. They did not look too much like humans. They were much taller than humans. They did have shoulders, but I didn't see the head.
He was huge, really huge, bigger than we are. He was a mighty figure.
I remember a crowd that gathered around the place. Everybody was scared. Everybody turned pale. I was absolutely flabbergasted.
I saw some traces there, and also a strange man. Outwardly, he looked like any other man, only he was huge. A moment later, he suddenly disappeared.
I had no doubt that the UFO and the giants existed, because I saw them. But sometimes when I look back, it seems sort of like a fairy tale.
Within a few minutes, you know, the door opens and a 10-foot tall, three-eyed, strange kind of, I don't know, overall clad, metal overalls, you know, sort of a creature comes out with a little small little, you know, square robot next to it. And sort of looks around, and it sort of gets weird. I guess they look around, they go back in their ship, they come out, they disappear, they look around. They're sort of doing this in and out thing with their flying saucer, and the kids are, the closest, and of course the more curious and the more adventurous, and also the dumbest. They're gonna approach this object and these beings, and at some point, these four kids that are getting closest to the object, one of them gets zapped by a rod that the big creature, the big three-eyed, 10-foot-tall guy, is holding. He points it at one of the kids that's getting too close, and he sort of freezes, mm-hmm. Not frozen like with icicles hanging off him, but like a suspended form of paralysis. Mm-hmm. And they get back in their ship, and then at some point they take off, and the kid gradually comes out of it. This whole series of events, I guess, is like maybe a half hour, 45 minutes. Certainly it seems like that, based upon all the descriptions, of sequence of events. But, it's one of those things where it's like everybody was like, hey, there's a UFO down in the park, so the crowd had actually gotten bigger. So they're not just the kids were witness to this playground event, but upwards of, maybe 50 people or maybe even into the hundreds, had begun to move down towards this park. So and then it hit the media, and it was a big deal in Russian press and then American press. Who knows?
Man, they always gotta try to outdo us, don't they?
Yeah. and the Russians, they did their investigation and their military police and all that. Interesting, though, the Russians were actually a little more open to this sort of thing back then. Hmm. So when they talked to like an investigator, some sort of general that was investigating the, the general would say stuff like, oh, it's probably aliens from outer space. Yeah, they're totally OK with saying that because, it's their news service, so they can say whatever they want.
Right. Yeah. If we've learned anything from RT News, that's kind of how it goes for sure.
Right.
All right, man. So on a more serious note, we are going to move to our final case, probably the most famous case to date. Many documentaries have covered it. There's going to be some more coming out. Even the Harvard psychiatrist, John Mack, was involved with this one. So please, to sort of cap all of these cases off for us, can you run us through the deeply dramatic Ruwa Zimbabwe case of 1994?
Absolutely. And this is probably one of the high caliber cases in this, subset of UFO investigation in history, mostly because of the quality of the investigation and the quality of the investigator involved in this. And, if Dr. John Mack, who was head of the psychological department, I believe, at Harvard at the time, mm-hmm. Taught at Cambridge University, really high caliber, learned man within legitimate psychiatry and psychology, began to take an interest in UFOs, not so much, with an idea of investigating the phenomena, but investigating people that claim interaction with the phenomena. Because as a psychologist and a psychiatrist, he was interested in, what they perceived, what they thought, if there was certain psychological components that he can explore. Can he deem through examination and psychoanalysis, if there was some sort of, reality to the circumstances involving, encounters with especially beings. And he would use hypnotic regression and some of the classic methods to explore that. So he was interested in the subject as a mainstream psychologist and as somebody interested in, as I had said, the psychological aspects of encounters. And so he was already on the radar. He was already out there. He had written some papers and, was under scrutiny by Harvard, relative to a big university, a legitimate university, should be involved in investigating, such things. And he was ultimately given academic freedom to explore these issues. And as a result, he began to get cases thrown to him. And he was coincidentally in Zimbabwe or near there back in 1994. And he was told of this case. at the aerial school in Rua, Zimbabwe, just outside of Harare. And he made it down there, I think within, you know, maybe a week or two of the initial encounters. And he was able to interview and investigate more so than anybody I've heard of, you know, a case, you know, relatively quickly on location, you know, after it happened.
They described these experiences or these events like a person talks about something that has happened to them. And when you're talking with a psychotic who's telling you something and it's a delusion and you feel that it really didn't happen, I can tell. I mean, I know this is something that person wants me to believe, or they're frightened, or they're distorting reality in some way. There's nothing like that here. These are people of sound mind, by and large, telling me something that's very... They know that I might think they're crazy, and so they're a little concerned about telling me, and they're very full of questioning themselves and doubt, and I mean the way, and then they describe something very real and intense, a light or something happened to their body, or it's the whole quality of the way they talk about it is the way a person talks about experience that happened to them.
What happened on September 16th, 1994? There were 60 kids at this aerial school, and Zimbabwe has, you know, had its periods of colonialism, you know, so there were different ethnic makeups within this school, different backgrounds, you know, white children and Indian children and African Native children all attended this school. It was very, you know, popular and organized and ordered school. And 60 of these kids this day were on the playground, and similar to, you know, the other accounts, they witnessed, you know, an object, you know, like a cigar-shaped or a flying saucer-shaped object land in the fields just beyond the school grounds. And similar to, you know, some of these other stories, they see a couple of men, and, you know, with the big black alien bug eyes, you know, sort of going in and out of this flying saucer. And and that's what Dr. Mack had gone down there to investigate. And these kids, you know, when he interviewed them, they told predominantly the same story, but they just had, you know, they had little minute sort of cultural changes, you know, cultural descriptions that were a little different, you know, relative to, you know, to the creature's appearance or even the appearance of the craft.
Something scared you, is that right?
Yes.
What scared you?
The noise.
What noise?
The noise that we heard in the air.
You heard a noise in the
yes.
air? What was it like? Like a roar or a buzz or a hum or what kind of a noise?
It was like someone was blowing a flute. It was scary myself.
It was scary because you saw something yourself?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a little object hovering. It was quite big, actually, and then there was little ones all around it. We saw something silver, and then we quickly ran to the logs, and we saw a silver thing, and we saw a man standing next to it.
What was it? What did it feel like when he was looking at you?
I felt scared.
It felt scared? What was scary about it?
Well, I felt scared because I've never seen such a person like that before.
Was he near the silver object, or was he far from
it? No, on top.
On top of the silver object. Okay. And did you look at him?
Yes.
Did he look at you?
Yes, then he gave me the creeps, then I stopped looking.
Gave you the creeps. Actually, in your drawing, you showed him standing up, didn't you?
Yes, I had to draw him standing up because I couldn't draw him sitting. What I thought was maybe the world's going to end. Maybe they're telling us the world's going to end.
That's sort of an interesting aspect. I think everybody involved, you know, the main investigators and Dr. Mack, you know, believed that there was some sort of encounter. And again, you know, you start getting into the, you know, when you investigate it, especially with children, you start to see these perceptual aspects that are kind of interesting. And for Dr. Mack, was the heart of his investigation. You know, some of those, you know, for instance, like the African children who witnessed it, sort of perceived like hair, you know, and they identified it as like a classic creature, you know, from their culture called a Togolishi, you know, which is like some sort of like spirit or some sort of being. So, you know, there's interesting stuff there to explore. I'm by no means an aerial expert. There are a lot of people out there that know a lot more. There are a number of documentaries coming down the road. I think Aerial Phenomena is one that is going to be coming out. And I think our friend James Fox has been doing some aerial stuff as well for his project. So yeah, and some of the children witnesses, they're grown up now, so they've taken to speaking about their encounters. Emily Trim is one. She's out there. She speaks about the encounter that she was involved with that day. And you know, some of the kids claim further encounters, or yeah, at least, you know, messages. You know, we sort of have that contactee aspect of you know, receiving messages by some of the witnesses, you know, utopian type stuff, which is fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's a great case. And like you said, the witnesses are still willing to talk about what happened to them, and it's clear that they're still affected by this, and they stick by their stories. So that's right. What I find most interesting about this one. It's the most current one we have to date, and it's also the one where we still have these witnesses around to tell the story. So this case is not going to die. These documentaries are only going to shine more light on it. So I'm excited to see where that goes.
Yeah.
Michael, these cases, it's astounding how many there are. And like you said right before we started, there's hundreds of more. But with all of these cases that involve children, I want to hear from you, man. In your opinion, do you think whatever is happening to these kids, do you think it's intentional by these possible intelligences? Are they actually targeting these children to appear to? Or is this all complete happenstance? Is it different for every case? Where do you sort of land in terms of why so many child UFO encounters happen?
Well, ultimately, I would say I think it's, you know, it's different in each case. You know, I do think that these cases have to kind of, you know, be viewed independently of each other. But, you know, the comparisons are really striking. You know, you can't get around that. I don't know what kids are seeing. Are they more open to that sort of thing? I would think that it's probably the personality, you know, of whoever is perceiving, I guess, whatever is being perceived, that's sort of a long way around of saying, you know, maybe it depends on the person, and maybe it does depend on the fact that these are children, and you know, perception does play its part into it. I can tell you myself, though, and I think you're right along there with me, that as a person who saw an object as a kid, mm-hmm, it definitely influenced me. It got me further interested into the subject. You know, I don't know if a lot of these people who saw these ended up going on to, you know, not too many of them that I've heard of have gone on to, you know, spread the UFO message or whatnot. But you know, at least for a time, they were vocal in the reality of what they saw. I don't know. I think, you know, some of these cases, maybe there's some sort of misidentification. Mass hysteria is always a possibility. Hoaxes are a possibility in some instances. All of these cases, I think, stand out in that, you know, when you start getting into hundreds of witnesses and you start moving out of, you know, the child demographic, and you're starting to get adult and other people seeing the same thing, then something is being seen then. You know, something is being experienced. You know, perceptions as to, you know, beings and all that, I find very intriguing, very interesting. What's going on? I don't know.
Yeah,
that's what makes these, you know, especially interesting. And you know, I'd love to track some more of these witnesses down to some of these cases to see how it's affected them long term, or if they've changed their mind. I think from those that have come forward, even to this day, they stand by themselves as children. You know, this is what I saw when I was a kid.
Yep, and you can't ask for more than that from a witness. You know, they have defied that sort of stigma that comes with reporting a UFO. They were kids, you know. There wasn't that this idea that I'm going to lose my job if I talk about this, or, you know,
right.
The Johnsons next door are going to talk about us. It's they're open, they're honest, and like you said, they're willing to be more honest than I think an adult would be in terms of coming forward with things like this. In terms of that, I have a question for you. In terms of, like, UFO organizations that investigate cases, do you think, in terms of these cases, that there should be some sort of organization that strictly deals with kids?
That's a good question. I think it's always advantageous to, you know, have people, you know, interested in specialized aspects of, you know, the subject and its history. As far as an organization, I think there's a pretty good Westall group on Facebook where a lot of these cases are discussed. It's Shane Ryan, the Westall investigator down there, and he's done some other investigations into similar school type events. I think his group would probably be a good one to sort of interconnect with different people. What makes these interesting and a little more problematic logistically for having a group is, these cases are all over the world, you know. So if we're going to interact, relative to these cases, you know, it's probably going to have to be a cyber organization like the Westall group. But definitely, I think it's a good area of focus. And there's other accounts out there. Yeah, we've just hit the iceberg, you know. The famous Delphos case was a child case.
Ooh,
the
yeah.
Cash Landrum was a child case. You know.
Yep.
There's a lot of our famous cases involve children, and it would be good for somebody to look into that. I think we got a lot of good searchers like Shane out there. Doing that for us, so.
Yeah, he is doing some great work. And again, the Westall case is definitely one people should look into. Well, speaking of children, Michael, many of my listeners, they know this, but some may not. You are the host of the Strange Travels blog, and don't think you weren't going to get away without talking about this, man. This is where you chronicle your adventures across the U.S. and with your children and your wife, which, again, I envy tremendously. And you've gone to some amazing places. This past year, tell me, debrief me, have you personally been to any places that you really want to talk about? Anything strange happen or really come to mind, stick out?
Oh, man. We're doing the same thing that we've been doing. I call myself a paranormal travel writer, but that's not really my job. I'm just a regular, you know, just UFO junkie here in Missouri. But I do take my wife and kids to interesting spots, and we'll visit the occasional famous UFO place. And I like to take pictures and document and share. The big thing probably this past year, we went to Kelly, Kentucky, home of the Kelly Hopkinsville encounter of 1955, you know, where a house was besieged by goblins.
Yep.
I'm sure everybody's familiar with it, but I went there for the eclipse, and it just so happens on the day, the anniversary of day of the eclipse was also the anniversary of the encounter.
Ooh, wow. Creepy.
So, and it was also the highest, longest duration point for the eclipse.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the epicenter of the eclipse at this famous UFO spot. So
we had fun
there, and I got to look around. I got to go on to the grounds of the property and then stand where the goblins were and look at the trees that they leapt up into, and even saw the flying saucer circular patch that their saucer supposedly landed in 1955.
Wow.
So that was one of the big highlights. But that's the sort of thing that we do. You know, they have a UFO festival and all that. But we like to do a lot of the paratourism and the UFO tourism, and we go to haunted houses and Bigfoot places, and we're still doing that, and we're still blogging about it. And thank you, Ryan. I know you've been liking a lot of my stuff and complimenting me. You've been a big supporter, and I do appreciate that.
Oh, I love it, man. It's more jealousy than anything, but no, I have a great respect for what you do and that you introduce this to your children. I think that's important. You're not telling them what to think. You're not telling them what all of this is. You're introducing them to a topic that many parents would be shy away from with their children. And, you know, we grew up having experiences, and that's what led us to do this. So I know I've asked you this on Into the Fray, but I want to ask you again, how do you deal with this with your kids? What do they take away from seeing the indentation where a possible UFO landed and goblins came out? What does a kid make of this? That would blow my freaking mind.
Well, well, first off, I'm jealous of my kids because I when I was a kid reading about this stuff, I wanted to go there immediately. You know, and look around, and, you know, so my kids are kind of lucky in that, you know, they get to go to a lot of interesting, places. And when they're there, they know what they're there for. They know that, you know, supposedly an alien was seen over there, or, you know, a Bigfoot was seen, you know, right where you're standing, whatever. And they think it's fun and they think it's interesting. Luckily they're into all this too. You know, they ask a lot of questions. I don't push, you know, hypotheses. In fact, I encourage my kids to come up with different ideas. And that's always fun. You know, when we're going through the TNT area looking for the Mothman, you know, my boys will get into a competition of theories as to what they think it really is, you know. But there's always that little bit of mystery that little kids maintain that always gives them a little bit of fright and a little bit of, intrigue and a little bit of mystery, you know, within them that keeps them engaged. And my kids, luckily, they love monsters and aliens and all that. And they love going along with me and exploring as well.
Oh, that's awesome. God bless them. Well, what can we expect next? Where are you guys heading this year? The year's almost wrapped up. What's coming next for you guys?
We're probably going to tool around here in Missouri, visit a couple of, local urban legends. You know, there's a couple of spooky haunted places and alien landing site that I need to check out before the end of the year. But next year, I think we're gonna go up to Hannibal, Missouri, visit Mark Twain's town, and have some fun up there. I think that's probably one of our big trips that we're looking to do. We're gonna go up there and maybe have my kids paint the fence, you know, in a Tom Sawyer, Huck Finn competition. I think that might be on Mark, but.
That's great, man. It's not all UFOs and ghosts and goblins. You got to teach him some literature too, right?
Well, but, you know, Ryan, there's a lot of it. Also, right near there is the first Momo sighting.
Okay.
The famous, couple famous UFO landing spots. So
I should have known.
I'm still going to take advantage of. Of course, there's haunted places in Hannibal, I'm sure. So, yeah, we're going to do the weird stuff while we do our normal family stuff, you know.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. Well, I mean, where can we find out more about what you're doing?
Well, I am all over social media. You can find me on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, you know, all that good stuff. I'm usually on Facebook quite a bit. And if I'm posting something somewhere or talking on the radio somewhere, I usually put a link up there. So just look me up there and you can follow what we're doing. I do have my WordPress blog. Keeping at it. Still working on the book. Hopefully we're actually expanding that, and we're going to do some art projects connected with it. But when it's done, it's done. You know, we'll see how it goes. But you know, it's a lot of stuff out there. A lot of stuff you want to do, and we're keeping at it. But always interested in making more friends. And if anybody's got a cool place they want to tell me about or a cool story, I'm always good to hit up for a chat.
Awesome. That's so great to hear, man. Well, this has been an absolutely fascinating crash course and a subtopic of UFO sightings that doesn't get talked about often, and I'm so glad that this is what we landed on. I know I've wanted you on since I started the podcast, and we couldn't really, like, nail down a topic, but I think this was a good one. We haven't talked about it before. There's clearly a lot of questions to still be asked about why all of these child UFO encounters happen, and I couldn't think of a better person to do that today, so thank you again for coming on Somewhere in the Skies.
Thank you, Ryan. It is a pleasure, and you're doing a great job with the show. Keep at it, buddy.
That is it for this week's episode. All of Michael Huntington's work can be found on Facebook and on Instagram. Just search for Huntington Strange Travels. If you really want to help out Somewhere in the Skies, please consider subscribing, rating, and reviewing on iTunes. It truly helps more than you know. Somewhere in the Skies is on Twitter at Somewhere Skies and on Instagram at Somewhere Skies Pod. The official merch store is open with several different designs. Visit teepublic.com and search for Somewhere in the Skies. That's teepublic.com. I will see you here next week. And remember, keep your feet on the ground, but never stop searching Somewhere in the Skies.
Somewhere in the Skies is produced by Third Kind Productions in association with Antica Productions and the Antica Podcast Network. To learn more, visit anticaproductions.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.